the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you today live from Tampa, Florida, here in the studios of WTBN in Tampa Bay. It's good to be here in Central Florida, especially here in Tampa, where we have so many loyal listeners at WTBN and throughout the Bay Area here. I'm here with my dear friend, Dr. Ken Whitten, pastor of the Ottawa Baptist Church here in suburban Tampa. And it's just good to be in an area where, frankly, it is pretty close to where I was born. So my roots are very close by in Lakeland, Florida, where I was born. And here with Thanksgiving week, there's an awful lot of reconnecting going on with families in transit. I was in two airports today, and let me tell you, I was not alone. There are a lot of folks out there who are traveling. And I hope for you and your family a very, very happy and fulfilling Thanksgiving season. And, of course, the celebration coming up, it's all eyes now on Thursday and Friday of this week. And the long Thanksgiving holiday, and especially Thanksgiving Day on Thursday. Later this week, we're going to be talking about just reframing the whole Thanksgiving question and what that means for us, especially looking at it from a Christian worldview. Really asking the question, we're going to be talking about this tomorrow, how in the world do you envision Thanksgiving without one to whom we express thanks, ultimately, cosmically, in terms of the one who is the God and creator of us all. And as Christians, we address our thankfulness to the one who indeed is our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, the Father who sent Jesus Christ as our Savior. And even as in the Lord's Prayer, we are taught to pray with gratitude. We understand that Thanksgiving is an appropriate focal day just to remind us not only what we are to do, but who we are to be every day of our lives. We're going to be talking today about a very interesting nexus of articles, an intersection of two different articles from two different coasts, both of them telling us a great deal. If you were looking at the Sunday paper in the Los Angeles Times yesterday, here's what you saw, an opinion piece with the title, Monogamy Isn't Easy, Naturally. It's by David Barash. And Professor Barash has written a book in which he's arguing that evolution suggests that human beings are not naturally monogamous when it comes to reproduction and the building of relationships. According to Professor Barash, monogamy isn't natural. He says, however, it's nonetheless a fine idea. And we're going to be talking about why that's a pretty thin and flimsy argument for monogamy, but also why it tells certain people what they want to hear in the society today. But if you were on the other coast, there on the East Coast, if you were in New York City and you looked at your Sunday paper, you saw a most amazing cover story in the New York Times Magazine. Time and time again on this program, we come back to the New York Times Magazine because it's one of the most interesting cultural barometers about the issues out there. Now, here's the cover story. Who Knew I Was Not the Father? It's by Ruth Padower. And it concerns the fact that an enormous number of dads in America are discovering they're actually not the fathers of their children, or those they thought were their children. And with the age of DNA now upon us, with DNA tests now so inexpensive that you can go down and get one at the corner drugstore, it's turning out that this is raising whole new questions. Well, it goes right back to the article from the Los Angeles Times about monogamy. It's a heartbreaking article, the cover story in the New York Times Magazine, because it suggests that many fathers go through a process, or husbands, or those who thought they were fathers and may once have been husbands, they go through a horrible process of trying to envision what it means now when they find out that the child they have known and cared for is not their child. And some of these stories are really twisted and complicated, as you would expect. We're going to be talking about both of these stories today because the underlying issue is monogamy. If you look at the New York Times Magazine, you look at that cover story, monogamous marital relationships would preclude this entire problem. What we're looking at here with this flurry, indeed avalanche, of DNA testing having to do with paternity, what we're looking at here with all of these horrible and convoluted cases with so much pain and so much agony and so many legal questions of untold complexity, what we're really looking at here is the debris of a culture that has abandoned the ethic of monogamy. And we're going to be talking about what that means, and I want you to join the conversation. The phone number is always 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. From two different coasts, two different articles, one major issue, which is monogamy. From the West Coast, David Barash writing in the Los Angeles Times, monogamy isn't easy. He's writing from an evolutionary perspective. It's really interesting. He says, as an evolutionary scientist, I'll tell you, monogamy isn't natural. But he says it's still a good idea. Pretty thin argument, but he says that even as playing the violin doesn't come naturally, neither does monogamy, but both take years of dedication and hard work. Well, if you look at the New York Times Magazine cover story, it looks like a lot of folks aren't putting in the practice. And this cover story, Who Knew I Was Not the Father by Ruth Padower, it's really horrifying. And it's the kind of thing that I would not discuss just on its own, but looking at the intersection of these two articles, it seems to me that something's going on here. When you have an article from the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times, both of them coming back to say that monogamy is the issue. Well, if you have two secular newspapers saying monogamy turns out to be underlying both of these stories as a major issue, we need to talk about it. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Let's talk about this. The phone number 877-893-8255. We're always glad to hear from you by social media. That's at Twitter / Albert Mohler and / Mohler Radio. At Facebook, the Albert Mohler Program. Those of you who use email, we're thrilled to hear from you by email at mail@albertmohler.com. If you go to the website at albertmohler.com today, you'll find a major article. It's entitled, Why I Signed the Manhattan Declaration. And it's a statement about why I signed that major statement that was released last Friday at the National Press Club. And you'll find my article there today, and I'm sure there'll be an interesting discussion that will flow from that. We talked about it on this program last Friday. If you missed that program, you'll want to go to the website at albertmohler.com and listen to that archived edition. You can also, of course, go to iTunes and listen to the podcast. It's one of those things that comes down to a very important aspect of life, which is at some point you have to take a stand. And taking that stand is very important. Get the podcast by going to albertmohler.com for that program from Friday. All right, fast forwarding to a couple of other issues. Did you see the receipts from the new movie in the Twilight Saga series, New Moon? This second in the series, based upon the novels by Stephanie Myers, it reduced even a movie like Dark Knight, that Batman movie, to second place. Dark Knight pulled in what was then a record $67.2 million in its opening day, but New Moon really shot that all to history by bringing in $72.7 million. Over the weekend, $140.7 million. We've talked about the Twilight movies and what they really represent. And it's the fantasy of, after all, here you're talking about a vampire. And there are so many interesting aspects to this. This is a chick flick. I mean, no doubt about it. As a matter of fact, the reports are coming back saying that only 20% of those who saw the movie were male, presumably dragged there or brought there by some female loved one. You know, when you look at the adolescent fantasy going on here, we've talked about it on this program. We've had some experts in to talk with us about that, what it really represents. Very interesting stuff. I have some grave worldview concerns about it. It's not the biggest issue in the world. This is not one of those, you know, break glass in case of emergency if your daughter has, the Twilight series that she's given her soul to the Satan worshiping crowd. That's not it. It is to say, however, that there are some elements in this that, from a Christian worldview, are highly problematic. And the vampire issue, the whole occultic issue, is only part of it. There is far more here. Because what this is really being presented by, as acknowledged by Stephanie Meyer, the author of this series of novels, is a female longing for romance. And it's a longing for romance that is met in a most unusual way. Indeed, I have to tell you, in a very troubling way. This is a vampire, and we're supposedly told that he's a good vampire because he doesn't drink human blood, only animal blood. This young man is creepy. He watches this teenage girl sleeping. There's clearly a seduction going on. And parents, if you think that that's innocent, well, let me just ask you to think about that for just a moment. But the other interesting aspect of this is really offered by USA Today. In today's edition, the headline is Women Mooning Over Teen Moonlight. It turns out that the success, rip-roaring success, we're talking about an opening weekend of $147 million, which ranks now third among all motion picture releases. It turns out that's being fueled not only by females, teenage in variety, but also by their mothers and grandmothers. Big half-page article in USA Today suggesting that this really demonstrates that there are an awful lot of older women who are finding escapism in the same kind of fantasy. Well, folks, maybe there is a tie here to where we began this conversation and that point to which we will return in just a moment, and that is the question of monogamy. You know, whether male or female, one of the greatest dangers to any marriage, one of the greatest threats to monogamy, is allowing fantasies that subvert that monogamy and that first relationship, that covenant relationship between a husband and a wife, and even before the marriage takes place, puts in the poison pill of something that just isn't real. You know, I'll tell you this much about monogamy. It's very real. It's one of the reasons why it matters. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Miller Program. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. Very interesting juxtaposition of two articles, one from the West Coast, one from the East Coast. From the East Coast, the New York Times Magazine cover story on the age of DNA and how that's creating all new questions about paternity. Ruth Padower, writing in this article, takes us into some very, very horrifying paternity territory. Get this. Over the past decade, the number of paternity tests taken every year jumped 64% to more than 400,000. By the way, that's only a subset of the tests because those are the ones that are legally actionable. They have evidentiary value. There are untold numbers far beyond that are just the get a test and send it off to a lab and get the results back. You're talking here about the ability to go into the corner drugstore and get a test, swab the inside of your cheek and that of your child, and mail the samples to a lab. You find out whether or not the child is actually yours when it comes back. According to this news story in the New York Times, 30% of these are coming back. It's not your child. Now, remember, that's 30% of those who evidently already have the question. After all, they're doing the test and sending it off, but still, that's a frighteningly high percentage. I told you this is a horrifying story. It really, really is. It presents this kind of moral conundrum. Here's a man who discovers that his child is not his own. Meanwhile, his wife divorces him. He is found legally responsible for child support. He's legally obligated to support the child. Then he finds out the child is not his child. Then he finds out that his wife has married the father of the child, who is now living off of his money as he's paying child support for the child that isn't his and actually is biologically the one who is now married to his wife. You think that's horrible? That sounds like it's right out of some legal case book, hypothetical. But that story going forward and backward is written throughout this article. And by the way, there are all kinds of twists and turns in here. There are folks who say, look, this is legal new terrain. This is now the age of DNA. We're trying to figure out what to do. At least one state has suggested that before a father accepts paternity of his child, he should do a DNA test in order to get this absolutely determined. The same way that the hospital is very, very determined to make sure that the child that goes home with the mother is actually the mother's child. So also, with the age of DNA and the rise of this technology, those who are suggesting a father should as well. The twists and turns in this particular article are way too convoluted to take up in this program, but it is rather interesting to note what this article really never gets to, and that is that this is an entirely avoidable problem. And the means of avoiding it is marriage, and in particular, monogamous marriage. If one is engaged in monogamous marriage and engages in sexual relations only within the context of monogamous marriage, then this can't happen. But what we're looking at here is the New York Times, in all honesty, trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again without a marital ethic of monogamy. And that isn't going to happen. There is no way to get out of this. The problem is just too complex. The legal authorities cited in this article more or less throw up their hands and say, we have no idea how to handle this. Weighing the rights of the actual father, the rights of the putative father, the rights of the child, the rights of society, that's horrifying stuff, which is, by the way, why civilization depends upon marriage and integrity in marriage, or all things, all bonds, all institutions, all relationships, all laws, all structures begin to dissolve. This is just evidence of it. what's really interesting to me is that the New York Times just deals with this as a real legal and ethical conundrum, but never actually gets to the fact that if these mothers had not had sex outside of marriage, this would not be happening. This would not be a question. We would not be looking at this news story. Sometimes what's most evident in a media report is what's not there at all. But the issue of monogamy certainly is there from the article on the West Coast. The article is by David Barash. It's an opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times. Appeared on the same day, that's yesterday, Sunday, November 22. And the title of this one is Monogamy Isn't Easy Naturally. Listen to this. Here's one paragraph, the second paragraph in the article. First, there can be no serious debate about whether monogamy is natural for human beings. It isn't. A Martian zoologist visiting planet Earth would have no doubt Homo sapiens carries all the evolutionary stigmata of a mildly polygamous mammal in which both sexes have a penchant for occasional, quote, extra pair copulations, end quote. Interestingly enough, this evolutionary biologist goes on to say, but natural isn't necessarily good. Think about earthquakes, tsunamis, gangrene, or pneumonia. Nor is unnatural bad or beyond human potential. Consider writing a poem, learning a second language, or mastering a musical instrument. Few people would argue that learning to play the violin is natural. After all, it takes years of dedication and hard work. So here's a man who's writing, look, it's not natural, he says. Evolution really implies that looking backwards, we see all the DNA evidence of the fact that there's a whole lot of something beyond monogamy going on. On the other hand, looking forward, he says that we can learn this. We can learn this behavior of monogamy. Very, very interesting. Of course, like all of these evolutionary scientists, he goes to the animal world and comes out saying, look, beavers establish lasting pair bonds that enable them to cooperate in building a valuable, complex home sites. If it's good for the beavers, maybe it'd be good for human beings as well. He says this, to be sure, monogamy isn't easy, nor is it for everyone. Now, that's very interesting. In other words, it's something you choose. That's why I published a mini blog post on Twitter just a little bit ago saying that this man thinks monogamy is just an idea, but maybe a fine idea, but not for everyone. But anyone who claims, he writes, that he or she simply isn't cut out for monogamy misses the point. No one is. At the same time, no one's biology precludes monogamy either. Well, let's look at the bottom line of this. From the New York Times Magazine, here's the evidence. They evidently are able to consider this whole question of fathers finding out they're not actually the fathers and the whole legal complex that that follows from that without ever really dealing with the moral question, which is not paternity, first of all, but the failure of monogamy. It's the sex outside of marriage. Without sex outside of marriage, there would be no phenomenon we're talking about here. There would be none of these heartbreaking stories. There would be no cover story in the New York Times Magazine. There'd be no legal debate. And then from the West Coast, you have this evolutionary biologist suggesting that monogamy isn't easy. It's not natural, he says, but it can be a learned behavior. It's not for everyone, but it is nonetheless a good idea. It can be learned the same way that you can learn to play a musical instrument like the violin. It's not natural, but it requires a certain talent, and it requires practice. Well, the bottom line in that one is that just shows you again the absolute intellectual limitations of the evolutionary worldview. Because the evolutionary worldview says, look, you just look at what is, and you try to draw certain inferences, and that's all you've got. It's a blind, naturalistic process. There is no morality that is written within it. All that that evolution suggests is that this is the means whereby natural selection has selected out certain individuals, certain behaviors, certain traits, and what we call moral is simply a successful evolutionary meme or behavior or mechanism. And, you know, I'll just suggest to you this. And I mean this with everything I can put into it. I don't think there's anyone who's going to be tempted to violate monogamy who's going to say, you know, there was an evolutionary biologist who suggested that that even though monogamy is not natural and what I'm contemplating doing is more or less natural, that maybe this is a behavior I can learn the way I can pick up a musical instrument. You see, I just don't think that has any binding authority whatsoever. I want to know what you think. You see, here's the bottom line. I think once you abandon the Christian worldview and a Christian understanding of marriage and monogamy, once you abandon that and you take the word ought out and all you've got is that monogamy is a good idea, I don't think it's going to work. Tell me what you think. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Is monogamy just a good idea? Let me know what you think. Live from Tampa, Florida, this is the Albert Miller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, one of the most interesting things about the human species is our ability to ignore the obvious. The New York Times Magazine cover story did that just yesterday, dealing with this whole question of all the contested paternity without ever dealing with the reality of extramarital sex. That's how this happens. Then you have on the West Coast this article about monogamy not being natural, but suggesting it can be learned. It's not for everybody, it says, but nonetheless, it has some benefits. I'm just suggesting that you put the two of those things together, and there's a colossal effort, an almost intentionally colossal effort, to ignore the obvious, and that is that without monogamy, we've got big trouble. Now, from a Christian perspective, we've got a different angle on this. We don't believe that monogamy is just a good idea. We don't believe that it is unnatural, by the way. We believe that human beings were made for marriage, which means we were made for monogamy. But we are living in a Genesis 3 world, and just about everything we know has been completely corrupted by sin. And human beings not only have the capacity to sin and to invent new sins, but we are the born rationalizers of that sin. And it turns out that the theory of evolution, well, it affords a nice little cover to justify, let's just say breaking monogamy, if that's your plan. And my argument is this. I want to know what you think about this. My argument is you're trying to convince someone of the importance of monogamy. It's pretty hard to do it without God. I'll just state it just that bluntly. It's pretty hard to stress monogamy as a binding moral principle without God. But I want to hear from you. Let's just say someone comes up to you at the workplace. A fellow student comes up to you at the college university campus. Someone's talking to you at the PTA meeting and says, well, okay, you're monogamous. Why? Why should marriage be monogamous? Let's get the arguments out there. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You know, you got to have an argument. And let's just say that you are engaged in a marriage committed to monogamy. I certainly hope you are. Okay, but why? Why? Is it just a good idea? Is this article from the Los Angeles Times right? Is it just a good idea? You bought into the idea? Or is there more to it than that? Or is it so far off the screen that, like the New York Times Magazine yesterday, it's not even speakable? Because to bring in monogamy, you're just going to get tarred and feathered as a Puritan and told you're out of it. Even the article about monogamy being a good idea says it's, by the way, from the secular perspective, not for everyone. Again, the phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're also glad to hear from you by social media at Twitter/Albert Mohler and Mohler Radio. And Facebook, the Albert Mohler Program. Email, mail@albertmohler.com. Let's just think about trying to make that argument, all right? So we got somebody sitting next to us in the college cafeteria, the coffee shop. Well, are you committed to monogamy? Yes, when I'm married, I will be committed to monogamy. Well, why? Well, you know, I think it's a good idea. I want to concede that evolution turns out to suggest that maybe we're not meant for monogamy, but nonetheless, I think it can be learned. I learned to play the violin. I learned to play the piano. I learned to do this. So I think I can learn to be monogamous. Doesn't that sound like a very weak argument to you? I mean, so weak as to lose all traction, and it loses traction, it loses credibility and force at the very point in which we need it, which is when people are deciding whether or not they're going to commit adultery. And that's one of the big problems we have. Often, even in the Christian church today, we will not state things as they ought to be stated. So let me take a stab at stating it as it ought to be stated. Speaking as a Christian to Christians here, we are committed to monogamy because we are followers of the Lord Jesus Christ. We're committed to monogamy even before we're married, not to mention after we're married, because we understand that we have been bought with a price. We are not our own. We didn't create ourselves. We're not our own lawgiver. We certainly will not be our own judge. And the God who will judge us, the God who saved us through the blood of his own son, is the God who knows what is best for us and for his glory and for our good, says marriage is this and not something else. And marriage is a monogamous relationship. You get outside that monogamous character of marriage, and you're subverting marriage, and you're making marriage a lie, and you're making the marital oath a lie. You're making yourself a liar with the vows that you took. You know, when you start looking at the difference between the argument that has an ought and an ought not in it, and the argument that says this is a good idea but not for everyone, I think you can see how far our society has really conceded the ground on the issue of monogamy in marriage. Folks, what we're talking about here is not a hypothetical. You know, that's what really makes this whole question so tragic. If all we had was the article on the West Coast, you would think, well, there's an evolutionary scientist just trying to offer some kind of interesting opinion and a way of selling his book, perhaps. But you can join that with what we have in the New York Times cover story, this horrific story about all these men finding out they're not the fathers of the children they thought were their own, and you see the fruit of the tree. We'll be right back with more, live from Tampa, Florida.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, one of the themes we come back to time and time again is the limitations of the evolutionary worldview. And just let me remind you of this. To really get inside the understanding of evolutionary theory, it's a naturalistic, materialistic box. In other words, it's a theory that suggests that the natural world is self-explanatory. And you bring anything from outside the natural world, they say, hey, you can't do that. That violates the whole principle of natural selection and, exactly how they are absolutely certain that evolution took place. And so when you start looking at evolution as a worldview, you realize it's got to answer everything. And this is where folks like Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, they get it. You know, the two of the leading evolutionary scientists in the world today. Stephen Jay Gould, yeah, he gets it. Daniel Dennett probably puts it better than anyone else when he says, look, you know, evolution is a completely intellectually satisfying idea, he says, because it provides the answer to everything. That's where, by the way, I think they have to be most frustrated, because it's clear that that people don't buy that. I mean, they're absolutely convinced that it answers everything. And, you know, the people just are absolutely convinced that it doesn't, indeed, that it can't. You know, I've talked about this before. From an evolutionary perspective, a mother's love for her child is nothing more than an evolutionary nurturing mechanism. That's all it is. Evolution simply selected out mothers who took care of their children because there was this emotional bond rather than mothers who did not, because the genes that survived were those of the children who were cared for and nurtured. Therefore, mothers turn out to be nurturing. And it's all in the genes. And so there's nothing really special about that relationship between mother and child other than replicating genes. You know, I'll just tell you, I don't think people buy into that. And thus, when you come to an issue like marriage and monogamy, they've got to explain monogamy. They've got to explain non-monogamy. And so you have someone like the author of this article, David Barash. He's the author of a book, by the way. He co-authored it with Judith Eve Lipton. It's entitled Strange Bedfellows, The Surprising Connection Between Sex, Evolution, and Monogamy. Well, there you got it. He's selling a book. I know what that's like. I know how that works. But let me tell you, you're selling a book on the strange connection between, or surprising connection between, sex, evolution, and monogamy. Well, you know, here he is. He believes that evolution explains all of this. And that's why he comes back to say, you know, evolution suggests that monogamy isn't natural. But that's not to say it's not a good idea and then it can't be learned. It's not going to be easy, but it can be a learned behavior. You know, you look at that, and again, my point, I just have to come back to it, is that I don't think that's going to be compelling. You know, that's the interesting kind of argument that you can picture evolutionary scientists discussing around some table somewhere. But, you know, when you have a couple who are contemplating breaking their marital vows, I don't think evolution is going to enter into their moral examination. I don't think being concerned with evolution is going to keep them from doing what they are contemplating doing. I do believe that he's right about one point, and this is where I think we need to end this discussion. I believe that David Barash is fundamentally right about something, and that is that monogamy is hard work. It is. In a Genesis 3 world, in a fallen world, monogamy is hard work, but it isn't merely a good idea. That's where I part company with this evolutionist. Our worldviews are just completely incompatible. His worldview is derived from an evolutionary scheme. My worldview is derived from a theistic creational understanding in which, you know, I believe that everything that is bears testimony to the fact that it was created. It also bears testimony to the fact that there has been some catastrophe, and we know that that's the fall. And thus, it is the Christian worldview based in Scripture that is able to look to things and say, yes, there is an ought. There is an ought in this. It's not merely an is. But in a fallen world, the ought is sometimes hidden. What am I talking about? Well, we believe that because God created everything that is, that every atom and molecule of the entire universe is part of a great moral universe, and not just a material universe. And we believe that the morality is not just something that could be developed by the naturalistic parts working together. It's that which is brought from outside of us. It is the law that is given to us by God. Now, you see, when you're talking about law, well, there you're talking about something that's either obeyed or disobeyed. If you're talking about some kind of blind evolutionary process, well, it's kind of ridiculous to talk in terms of obedience or disobedience. You're talking about a command, a law, a statute. We know what obedience and disobedience looks like. You're talking about some blind, naturalistic, materialistic evolutionary process. Well, all they can argue is for is, not for ought. You know, what we're experiencing in this country is the loss of a consensual shared ethic. It's becoming more and more clear every single day. Just look at the evening news, go to the cable news, and just listen to even 10 minutes of the chatter or the shouting, and you'll understand there's a great moral divide in America. Listen to the kind of data that now come in from all kinds of different sources, surveys, polls, and all the rest. Listen to the kind of conversation going on the average college university campus. Listen to the kind of conversation, for that matter, going on in the average nursing home or retirement center. Folks, there is a great moral divide in this country. And the bottom line is, it is increasingly between those who believe that there's a revealed morality that comes with an ought from a creator, an ought and an ought not. And that creator, of course, will also be our judge. On the other side, to those who believe that there are no fixed moral standards, there is no objective, absolute morality, and the best we can do is to try to cobble together an ethic that works best for us, that would lead, they would suggest, to maximum human thriving. Human beings turn out to be absolutely incompetent at doing that. Even if we granted the experiment, well, the 20th century alone should prove that the human beings are woefully inadequate for that task. We cannot be competent at being our own lawgiver, and we certainly are not competent at being our own judge. You know, the whole issue of monogamy, if it's just a lifestyle among other lifestyles, then it's not going to have compelling authority. If the society doesn't have the will, the moral will to say, this is the way relationships ought to be and they ought not to be another way, then the society will reap what it sows. If we're unwilling to say that being non-monogamous is wrong, well, again, we will reap what we sow. But that is pretty much what we're saying. When you look at out-of-wedlock births in this country being at 40%, normative in some neighborhoods and among some groups. If you look at what's going on with the majority of young adults cohabitating at some point before, or if they get married, when you start looking at the hooking up culture that starts now in middle school and younger years and goes forward, and then, well, you look at these two articles, one from the New York Times Magazine, one from the Los Angeles Times. Folks, we've got an uphill battle. But it's worth it. Not because monogamy is a fine idea, but because the Creator who knows us and loves us said, this is what marriage is, and this is why it matters. There is an ought, and an ought not. We'll be back with final thoughts in just a moment. Live from Tampa, Florida, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I am here in Tampa, Florida. Thanks to the folks here at WTBN, Mike Serio, Operations Manager, Christopher Gould, Station Manager. We're really, really thankful for our listeners here in Tampa, and I'm always glad to be here in the Bay Area. I came here from New Orleans, Louisiana. Just want to leave you with a final thought. Yesterday, I was at Franklin Avenue Baptist Church there in New Orleans. My dear friend Fred Luter, pastor. It was a great, great Sunday morning, just a great time to be there. Before the service, I had a tour of the Ninth Ward, the lower Ninth Ward there in New Orleans, and a couple of things I want to mention. First of all, it's just amazing to see, even years later, the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, and to recognize that very real human beings are living in these homes that are now completely devastated, blown apart, uninhabitable, condemned. And some of them, it just looks like Armageddon almost has taken place, neighborhood by neighborhood. Then you see these new blocks going up. And one of the sweet things to see is how many Christian churches, how many congregations are there rebuilding homes, building new homes and rebuilding a community. A lot of inspiration, just seeing folks who are so tenaciously committed to rebuild a city, and there Fred Luter and so many in his congregation are rebuilding a neighborhood, determined to go back. So many of their folks went to Baton Rouge and Houston and points beyond, relocated after the disaster of Hurricane Katrina. By the way, again, it's just hard to recall that it was the next May, months and months later, before they had mail delivery there in New Orleans. It was months before electricity was reconnected to much of the city. And a lot of folks never came back. But here you have a congregation representing others as well that is determined to rebuild a city. And also to rebuild a ministry there, a vibrant church committed to the gospel there in the middle of a very difficult place. But I want to tell you, the most profound thing I noticed about this was the sweetness of the spirit of the folks who were there. They know the Lord. They love the Lord. And they're doing a brave work, and they are glad to do it. It was a real honor to be there and to see the Franklin Avenue Baptist Church doing so well. And to see that from so many in the community, I heard again and again, if it had not been for these churches, that this city would simply have ceased to exist. Folks, you know, when you start thinking about what it takes to make a statement for the gospel of Christ, different opportunities are afforded in very many different ways. It's amazing to think, in the providence of God, how one of the most destructive hurricanes ever to hit North America became a real opportunity, not only to rebuild a culture, but to show a witness in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. As I said, I'm glad to be here in Tampa. We'll be back tomorrow live from WTBN. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.